Accession number 4784, Reel 4.
Reverend Sanbash, Reel 4. Did any little incidents ever occur during these camps?
Yes, one in which I was actively involved. Being the chairman of the married quarters, I always accompanied the Japanese on what they called their outside roll calls. And we started the roll call in our area when somebody whispered to me that Miss So-and-so was not present. I said, "Where is she?" He says, "She's in the toilet." So when we came to that particular section, I had to say, Miss So-and-so is not present, but I know where she is. Hoping that they would take that, you see. So they said, "Where is she?" So the word for going to the toilet in Japanese is benjo. I said, "Benjo." She said, "I must see her." I said, "You can't do that to a lady." He said, "I must see her." So off we went to the toilets. And I knocked on the door. And I said, "The Japanese insist upon seeing you. So when you've made yourself respectable, open the door." So eventually she opened the door and he bowed very graciously and accepted that she was actually present. But it was an event that was talked about for a long time in the camp.
I'm surprised to hear he bowed graciously.
Oh, yeah. The Japanese were a mystery in some ways to us. There were times, I mean, as chairman, I had to go up to Japanese headquarters pretty well every day of my life on some sort of mission. There were times when they were as hostile as could be, sometimes very physical. Other times you'd have thought they were all playing a game together and that we were the best of pals, and they treated us very graciously. That was the puzzle about the whole thing. And you never knew from day to day which mood they were in when you got there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the incidents of the outdoor roll calls.
Now, what sort of channels of communication did the Japanese establish between themselves and the internees? How did it work?
Oh, through the members of the camp. The camp committees, rather. For the married quarters, for example, anything that happened, they either sent for me or came down to me. And so it was with the other areas. And that's how they found out what they wanted to know. And that was how they gave their orders. And that is how they got done what they felt they wanted to be done. Mm. It was all done in that sort of way. The ordinary internee, he need not have hardly any connection whatever with the Japanese authorities in the camp if he kept out of their way. And it was policy for them to do so. Because those of us who were the go-betweens, the ones to whom they came, there were times when we were in a very delicate position, and there were times when you were in a very dangerous one. Because if anything had happened for which you may not have been responsible in any way, if they discovered it had happened, they took it out of me, physically.
Mm. Now, were these communications regular? Did you have weekly meetings, monthly meetings, or whatever? Or were they ad hoc? They were summoned when need arose.
Ad hoc. But they were in and around the camp, you know, mostly all the time.
Mm.
And they could turn up at any moment. But they kept a very regular contact with the camp and with those of us who were the people of authority within the camp. They kept in very close touch with us.
Now, if they were ad hoc, what kind of needs would arise which would prompt either the internees or the Japanese to convene such a meeting with appropriate representatives?
Difficult to say much about that. As they came in and out of the camp and as we associated with each other, you would talk together about what was happening in the camp. I would talk to them about what I thought were the needs of the camp in the hope that it would seed somewhere that would produce something. And they did this through their interpreters. one of whom became a great friend of the camp, because he turned out to be a Lutheran minister in Japan, a man named Watanabe.
And how do you spell that?
W-A-T-A-N-A-R-B-Y, Watanabe. And he was one of the men who came on roll calls. He was one of the men to whom I would give the figures when we weren't on open-air roll calls. And when we stood together, just talking for a few moments, as we always did, a time came when I felt I could mention to him some of the things that we needed urgently in the camp, say perhaps some medical drug or something of that nature. And on a future occasion, when I got back to my room, we would not do anything that we thought might start anybody looking and wondering what we're doing. I would feel in my pocket and it would be there. And that was the sort of association I had with him, and a very helpful one. And he used to come to some of our services. We kept contact with him until after the war, and contacted him in Japan. And on one of the programs that Eamon Andrews did, one of his This Is Your Life program, he had somebody who had been in Stanley Camp, and he brought Watanabe over from Japan to appear in that program, and then tribute was paid to him as to how helpful he had been to us whilst he was an interpreter in the camp. Actually, when things were getting toward the end, and when they did get to the end, we had to take Watanabe into our own custody to save him from his own people, because they felt he'd been much too friendly to us and perhaps had told us too much.
Whilst we're on the subject of Japanese personalities that you had to deal with, are there any others that you'd like to mention for any reason at all who stand out?
They brought in addition to Japanese, Formosans, and used them for guarding the camps. And we found them to be more difficult than the Japanese themselves. They were big, tough, strong, husky men. They were very, very rough, very physical, very objectionable, and we didn't like them at all. But there came a time when they served our purpose, and I'll tell you about this when I talk about the black market and how we got into it and how it ran, because we discovered that they were open to bribery. And that was the method we used to get them involved in our black market operations. And once we got them in, they couldn't get out because we didn't let them out. But they were the ones in addition to the Japanese, and they were difficult people.
Are there any other specific individuals in addition to Watanabe that should be brought into this story? I mean, what about the Commandants, for example? Are they memorable for any reason?
What happened in connection with the Japanese government of the camp through the years was this. The first appointment was made, and he came in with his staff. And a time came, I don't know how we British people do it, but I think we have this sort of facility in difficult circumstances. A time came when somehow we were able to handle them. And when the higher Japanese authority outside the camp sensed something of this, and that things were happening which hadn't happened before, and more was coming into the camp than they thought should be coming into it, what they did was to change the whole administration overnight and bring a new lot in, and obviously with instructions to stamp down on us. And this happened at intervals during the whole of the time. And that was our relationship with the Japanese authorities within the camp. They did, when they'd been in 2 or 3 months, there were times when the Japanese camp commandant and myself were very good friends indeed. In fact, on one occasion, when the weather got cold, and incidentally the weather did play quite a part in our experiences, because Hong Kong is not always a tropical place, he said, "You've got to come out taking roll calls every day," and he brought me an overcoat into the camp, which I had when I came back to England. I don't know if that lights the thing up at all. One of the Japanese supreme authorities over our camp was a rather objectionable character named Colonel Watanabe. I believe that years before that he'd been in America and had been engaged in fairground business and all that goes on in fairgrounds and that sort of thing. And he was a rough, tough character, and he was no good to us at all from the word go. And actually, when it was the men who was tried by the war crimes court, and several of us in the camp were called upon to give evidence at his trial, and actually he was ultimately executed for some of the devilish work that he did in the camp. On the other hand, there was another man who had been in authority somewhere in America in connection with overseas relations and the Japanese overseas departments, and he was very helpful to us and a great friend to us. Unfortunately, this was evidently realized among the higher echelons of the Japanese command, and he was taken from us at a time when he was doing us a lot of good.
Can you give me any examples of the kind of devilish things which the first of these two characters got up to?
Well, he was very physical.
Can you be specific?
Well, he would... If something had happened and he thought you had anything to do with it, he'd pick up the nearest bamboo pole that he could lay his hands on and lay about you. I've had that happen to me more than once. The only stupid thing that I felt I was conscious of doing was not falling to the ground the first time he hit me. The British attitude usually is to grin and bear it, to stand up and take it. It's ridiculous in conditions like that, but that's the sort of thing you find yourself doing until a moment comes when the penny drops and you say, go to the ground, you silly ass, and stay there.
Can you remember any particular incidences that provoked him to this kind of behaviour?
Oh, perhaps something that should have been done, or some repair work done, whatever he may have had in mind, and the man who was told off to do it hadn't done it. Well, he couldn't get at him, so he got at me, because I was the chairman of the camp, and I was regarded as being responsible for what other people did or didn't do. Actually, the worst hiding I ever did get, I didn't mind taking, because the man who would have got it was much older than I was, and it would probably have killed him. So I can say that, quite honestly.
What was that incident?
It was in connection with kitchen work and kitchen construction and the use of rations. Actually, he was pretty innocent himself, the poor chap. He was one of the heads of the Public Works Department in the Hong Kong government set-up. And he was an elderly man, and to be laid about with a bamboo pole by a fellow like Tokunaga would not have been funny.
So, now, what was the name of this particular officer?
Colonel Tokunaga.
And the Lutheran minister
was... The Lutheran minister was the Reverend Watanabe.
Having spelled Watanabe for me, could you spell the other one too?
I'm not sure about the spelling of Tokunaga. I suppose it would be something like Tokunarga.
Thank you. Still concentrating on your relations with the Japanese, but not on individuals, just generally speaking with guards as a matter of day-to-day contact, what was their general and overall attitude? I mean, were they sticklers for protocol?
Yes, they were sticklers for protocol, and here one perhaps ought to say something about bowing, because they made it an order that every time we ran into them or passed them or had anything to do with them, we had to bow. Then do your business with them and bow again before you left them. Their explanation was that they were the representatives of the emperor himself, and these courtesies must be given to them because they were really due through them to the emperor. And this bowing caused more trouble than a lot of other things in the camp, because it's one thing that the British do very badly. You sort of make an attempt to do it, but that didn't satisfy the Japanese. And on quite a number of occasions, they sent a delegation round the camp giving demonstrations as to how bowing ought to be done, how we must do it, and that helped quite a bit. It helped us to do it, but it went against the grain to bow as they wanted us to bow, sort of at right angles, you know, you bent over the body and really did bow. It went against the grain to bow to some of the people after what they were doing to us.
What was the typical reaction if they felt the bow didn't meet due
ceremony? Oh, physical. Physical, straight away. Physical.
Hand or stick or what?
Both. Both. Mm. And when we protested about this, as we did regularly, they used to say, you make too much fuss about this, because this is how we treat one another. And I must say that observing them, that was true. The higher in rank just did what they liked with the lower in rank, and very often it was physical.
Mm. As far as discipline generally was concerned, how would you describe it? I mean, was it slack or harsh?
Do you mean the Japanese control of us?
Yes, the general level, general standard of Japanese discipline amongst the
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, they kept a tight hold on us from the word go. I think we expected it anyhow. I think we realised that it was right that it should be so. As long as it didn't become too oppressive or too physical, I think we realised that there was nothing wrong in them having tight control of the camp. After all, 3,080 odd people are quite a number of people to keep in order. And the variations that you got among them, a number like that, both in age, character, upbringing, everything. We were a very mixed lot.
Apart from the bowing thing, which we've discussed, what were the other typical sorts of things that they would regard as offensive? And what kind of punishment would they exact?
Generally not recognizing them as they went about the camp. I think that they wanted, after they'd been there a while, they wanted to work out a reasonable relationship with us. That was my impression, anyhow.
What was the most extreme punishment you ever saw applied in your period at Stanley?
I've seen people beaten unmercifully until they were unconscious on occasion. Probably for something quite mistaken, which they probably hadn't done, but which the guard in question thought they'd done. The other tragedy in the camp, of course, was the executions. They took place out of the camp, but they were visible from within the camp to anybody who happened to be in the right place at the right time. And my own wife happened to be, merely by chance, one of those people. A group of responsible people in the camp were regarded as having engaged in espionage activities and activities which the Japanese regarded as being punishable by death. They were imprisoned in the Hong Kong prison itself, which was visible from our windows in our quarters. And then on a certain day, they were taken out in a van outside the camp to the hills outside, and there they were made to dig a trench, and there they were executed by beheading, and there they are buried to this day. And my wife happened to be passing through what we call the prison compound at the very moment when the vans passed, and one of the men just leaned out and said, goodbye, say goodbye to England for us, we know where we are going. And it's something that she has remembered ever since.
Yes, I'm sure it must have been indelible.
Oh, yes.
What was the nature of the espionage for which they were executed?
partly connected with what we had with one of our camp radios. To have a radio in the camp was an offence punishable by death. We had three radios in the camp that I knew about. Two, I think anybody else in the camp did know about, except myself and those who worked them. But another was more generally known about. And you always have your Judas in a prison camp. And we had those who betrayed us to the Japanese for reasons best known to themselves. Perhaps they were given some inducement, either extra rations or something of that nature. But certainly the Japanese came to know, through our own people, all about this radio, what was happening to it, who were using it. And ultimately, when we found that it was dangerous, we buried it. They knew exactly where it was buried. And these were the people who were supposed to be connected with this. I was arrested myself at the same time, although I'd nothing whatever to do with the radio or the operations of it. I knew the people and I had warned them that this would be the consequence for them if it was found out. Why the Japanese let me go when the others were taken out and executed, I shall never understand, except in some strange way to believe that my work in this world wasn't yet done. But that's what happened, and that's what happened to me.
I suppose the informants were never identified.
One or two were thought to be the one. And trials were held after the war in this connection, but no one was ever finally convicted. Some of us thought there was a miscarriage of justice in one case and that the man had been allowed to get away with it. But that is a fact. No one was brought to book on the matter.
If you had your suspicions, did that affect your treatment or attitudes to these particular
Certainly
individuals?
Certainly it did. Certainly it did.
Can you be specific?
Well, they were ostracized. And they were told very plainly what would happen when the war was over, because they'd be reported. And that is what did happen. But in this particular case, in some amazing way, he wriggled out of it. I wasn't there at the trial, so I don't know what happened.
We spoke about the number of internees at Stanley Camp, but what was the variety of them nationally?
There were seven different national groups in the camp, British, of course, being the dominant group. Most of us were British, including the Australians and Canadians. And then we had the Americans, over 300 of them. We had Dutch, about 50 or 60, Norwegian, Belgium, Poles, Greeks, and two who were stateless. And although some of those national groups were small in number, they did require that their countries of origin be taken into account and that they had some representation on the central governing council. But I do have to say that we had no trouble whatever in our relationships. We got on very well indeed all the way through. They accepted that the decisions would be made dominantly in British interests, but we included theirs, and they realized that we were giving them as fair a do as we could give.
Were any of those groups, those national groups, repatriated or exchanged?
The Americans were repatriated, I think I've said that, and the Canadians after them. The Americans were only in the camp for 7 months, so they were very lucky people.
You've explained that there were various blocks at Stanley. How did the accommodation vary in the various parts of the camp?
The best type of accommodation was that which had been occupied by the European warders, and that block became known as the main block. In the Indian quarters, the buildings were not of quite so good a character or well appointed. They had housed the Indian warders who were in the service of the camp. The Dutch, Norwegians and the other national groups occupied a group of buildings which had been centred round what had been used as the prison officers' club. And that accommodation was quite reasonable, of good quality. The only thing about all of it was, of course, that we were shockingly overcrowded, and there was never any answer to that because there was no more accommodation there.
Mm. Was there any noticeable difference in the quality of accommodation in those particular areas you've described?
No, in the Walders quarters, all the flats were of a pattern. In the Indian quarters, similarly so, all of a pattern, not quite so good. And the Dutch Norwegians, fairly similar to the Walders quarters, but again, perhaps just a grade lower.
Mm-hmm. What kind of furnishings and facilities would exist within these quarters?
When we got there, of course, a lot of looting had already taken place before anybody could get in. And the only quarters which had anything like furnishings were the boys' accommodation quarters of the St. Stephen's Boys' School. Consequently, those who were wise enough to make for those quarters when the camp was first occupied in the mad rush that took place when we first went into the camp, they were the only ones who found themselves with beds, furnishings, kitchen utensils, that sort of thing. In the Warders quarters and in the Indian quarters, there was very little. And one of the big jobs we had to do, and it took us a long time to get this really settled, was to get people with beds. In the early days, apart from two or three beds, most people had to lie on the floor. And it took us a long time to get camp beds into the camp. That's what we aimed at, and eventually succeeded, but it took a long time. Any other furnishings, people knocked together as time went on, stools, tables, that sort of thing. But furnishings were, well, at a minimum. And of course, with the overcrowding, there was no room for them anyhow. Mm. It was a case of having somewhere to sleep. And then they spent as much time out of doors as they could, fortunately, in the open spaces which we had.
Did you, Anusa Sandbash, have anything in your quarters to start with?
The only furnishings we had in that little armour room was a wooden frame of a bed. And I believe there were a couple of planks. It was a double-decker. She slept on the bottom tier, I slept on the top. And I managed to get one or two planks as time went on to give a basis. And on that, eventually, we got what was called a poogai, a sort of mattress with a bit of stuffing in, the straw, that sort of thing. And apart from a table and a stool, which I put together, that was the only furnishing that we had.
How do you spell puga?
P-U-G-U-Y.
Thank you.
Hyphenated. A sort of Chinese mattress.
Yeah. Lighting and heating, what provision was there for that?
In the early days, we had electricity, and there were a few electrical stoves about which had been used by the families, and in the early days we used those, and it was very handy. But within a comparatively short time from the beginning of the camp, all electricity was cut off, and from that moment on we had nothing in the way of light or heat. We lived entirely by the sun. What people did was to build what the Chinese called a chatty, a little circular porcelain affair in which you could use either scraps of wood or charcoal if you could get it. And any personal cooking that people did was done in that way. Heat, we had nothing at all. Fortunately, for, say, three quarters of the year, we didn't need it because Hong Kong is hot. As a matter of fact, summer is the time of the year that people rather dread because of the heat and the humidity. Actually, in camp, it was the time of the year that we enjoyed. So sparsely clothed. During the summer, the men went around in a pair of shorts, and that's about all. The ladies in shorts and bra. so that the summer heat was all in our favour. It was the winters that we dreaded, because although Hong Kong is tropical, the winters in an exposed place like Stanley could be very cold. And people used to put on every scrap of whatever they had to go to bed in order to keep warm. And those who had nothing further had to make do with old rice sacks. And that's how we managed.
What about washing arrangements and bathing arrangements? How did they fit into the quarters?
In the, well, in all of them, water had been piped on, naturally, in accommodation of that quality in normal times. So, again, in the early days, we had good supplies of water. But Hong Kong depends upon the heavens for its water. If there's a good rainy season, the reservoirs are full and there's no problem. In seasons where the rains are not quite so prolific, the reservoirs don't fill up and there are problems. And one of our big problems, one of our big scares, was shortage of water. Because there came a time when we had a bad rainy season and we were receiving water at that time just one day in five. And we had to do the best we could to store until the turn on day came again, one day in every five. And perhaps I'd better say a bit more about that with the spool that is running out, because this. So I'll carry on.
Yes.
The Japanese turned the water on. We tried to store. We had very little possibilities of storing anything like the amount that we should need. So first of all, we dug pits and asked the Japanese to let us have at least small supplies of cement in order to make them watertight. But like many other of our requests, that went unanswered. We did our best to puddle them with clay, but we never succeeded in getting a sort of pit that would hold water for any length of time.